Russians in Vienna Tehran offered its plans of action to members of the P4+1 in the form of two suggested draft documents, one relating to the removal of oppressive and unlawful US sanctions and the other to the nuclear issue. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom, France and Germany, all signatories to the nuclear deal, have raised concern over Iran's demands, claiming that they violate the provisions of the agreement. Iran yet denies this, saying it is adhering to the text of the previous rounds, but has expanded on issues like verification of sanctions removal.
Well, it's a problem because this is not simply a rational process. The other side, effectively, is a bloc of NATO countries that are involved in a series of wars in this West Asian region, and they are desperate to hang on to some new pretext, or this was an important pretext for them to try and submit Iran, to try and constrain the regional influence of Iran. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the nuclear issue at all, but as you can see, they've been trying to add new matters of trying to control Iran's missile capacity and so on. So,
as an informed source acquainted with the discussions told Press TV, the Islamic Republic's suggested drafts are fully compliant with the JCPOA and its principles. In an interview with Doha-based Al Jazeera on Friday, Iran's senior negotiator Ali Bagherikani also stated that Tehran's two proposed drafts cannot be rejected. In an interview with the Doha-based Al Jazeera network on Friday, Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagherikani stated that external players, particularly Zionists, are making major attempts to obstruct and disrupt the process of discussions between Iran and the P4+1 group of nations in Vienna. Right on the eve of the negotiations, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett alleged that the regime is very worried about the readiness to remove the sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman slammed the Israeli regime, saying Tel Aviv despises dialogue, since its genesis is based on war, tension, and terror. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that the delegates in Vienna won't take instruction from the Israeli prime minister. Naftali Bennett has accused Tehran of carrying out, quote, nuclear blackmail as a negotiation tactic and urged concrete measures against Tehran. This followed the Israeli foreign minister's visit to the UK and France to ensure that banking sanctions against Iran will stand. Tehran has warned the parties in Vienna not to be influenced by Israeli attempts to poison the talks.
But they are always worried about being abandoned. And of course, the threats they make against Iran are utterly empty, except in the sense that they count on or they rely on the fact that were there to be a serious conflict between the Israeli colony and Iran, the US would rush to back them up. But they're very worried that might not happen.
The US administration of President Joe Biden had said it was willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage. Iran says it won't settle for anything less than the removal of all US sanctions in a verifiable manner. It also wants guarantees that the U.S. would not abandon the agreement again. French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up his two-day tour of the Persian Gulf after a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Saturday. During Macron's visit to Jeddah, he and the Saudi Crown Prince discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis hit Lebanon. Beirut has been suffering from an economic crisis exacerbated by a diplomatic dispute between Lebanon and some Arab Persian Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, which had blocked imports. The rift between Riyadh and Beirut was sparked when former Lebanese information minister George Kardahi criticized the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Macron landed in Jeddah after visiting the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. His visit marked the first meeting of a Western leader with Mohammed bin Salman since the assassination of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed that a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. U.S. intelligence services revealed that the gruesome killing of Khashoggi was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman. Macron's visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to rehabilitate bin Salman. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations, such as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, threatening activists, imprisoning human rights defenders, slaughtering Yemeni civilians, and so forth. Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. However, in a stark contradiction to his assertion, the French president signed a multi-billion dollar military contract on a previous day with the UAE during his visit to the country as part of his tour.
The reality is that France will put money, will put business, will put profits before human rights, before freedom, and before democracy. And the French are very keen to expand their military relationship with Saudi Arabia, partly to increase the amount of revenue they receive from their annual weaponry sales to the kingdom, but also to compete with British military sales to the kingdom.
The UAE plays a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. During the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf, Macron gave a visit to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies slammed the agreement, blaming the UAE for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US.
France is a leading friend and ally to the Saudis. And on top of that, Saudi Arabia is the leading exporter and financier of terrorism in the world. And so, given that France has a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, demonstrates that not only is France complicit in terrorism, as is Britain and France, but also Paris has no regard whatsoever for human rights, democracy, or freedom.
Another country that has provided support for the Saudi regime despite its violations of human rights in Yemen is the United States. Last month, the Pentagon announced that the State Department had approved the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale followed the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The fact that the U.S. and France are the largest weapons exporters to Saudi Arabia brings one to the conclusion that Washington and Paris are only after selling their military hardware despite the war crimes Riyadh is committing, and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives and displacement of millions more during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences.
In the case of Ukraine, I think the Russian government has a right to be concerned that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is being played as a puppet of U.S. financial interests, U.S. political interests.
Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbass region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Barber, a far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Barber described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Barber further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Barbara apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Barbara's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Bobart over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Bobart posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter- and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result of Trumpian politics.
Anti-Muslim sentiment continued during the 2016 election cycle, during which Islamophobic hate crimes surged again. It is widely believed that the rise in hate to the anti-Muslim rhetoric was linked to the political discourse espoused by the political establishment in the U.S., especially the Republican Party and the people who gathered around former U.S. President Donald Trump, who made Islam and Muslims targets of criticism throughout his presidential campaign and tenure.
It's going to continue to be incredibly divisive from a domestic perspective, and it is going to, I think, drive more and more and more white supremacist, white nationalist policy, whether it be domestic or whether it be foreign. And I also think from a domestic violence perspective, we are going to see more and more examples of individuals taking matters into their own hands, using their own firearms, and attacking fellow citizens.
During the first months of the Trump administration, it was reported that roughly 75% of Muslim American adults said that there is a lot of discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Shortly into his time in office, Trump signed an executive order that barred immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Islam has been seen in the Western world in a negative light, which is fueling the wave of Islamophobic attacks on Muslims.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the laws on istihada, and you also, of course, according to Ayatollah Sistani's system of rules and laws, Islamic laws, and you talked about different types of istihada, and we already covered in the previous episodes about a few of the rules and laws, ritually speaking, about the little and the medium istihada. What about the excessive istihada? What is necessary? What is obligatory for a lady to perform in the state of excessive istihada?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, excessive istihada, as we can understand from the title, from the name, involves excessive bleeding. And when a woman is bleeding excessively, but irregularly, she is supposed to be in the state of excessive istihada. And of course, she has to follow the rules related to excessive istihada. A woman who is in the state of istihada is supposed to perform 3 ghusl, okay?
Yes.
3 ghusl during 24 hours in order to perform her daily 5 times prayers. Now, one ghusl has to be performed early in the morning before the Fajr prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And she has to, as soon as she performs the ghusl, she has to take quick action to perform the Fajr prayer, because there should not be any gap between the ghusl and the
and
prayer.
The prayer.
Because she might discharge blood.
Yes.
If there is a gap, if there happens to be a gap, okay? And then, of course, for the noon and afternoon prayer, or dhuhr and asr prayer, she has to perform another ghusl. And of course, she should not allow any gap between the ghusl and the prayers, because if there is a gap, then of course she has to perform ghusl again, because there is blood coming out. And this is the second ghusl she is supposed to perform. And then there's another ghusl which comes before the Maghrib and Isha prayer, or the evening and late night prayer. These 3 ghusl should be performed before the prayers, and there should not be any gap or any distance
mm-hmm.
between the ghusl and the prayers which are offered. And of course a woman should prevent the flow of the blood, whatever, maybe she might want to use a tampon or maybe a menstrual cup or whatever. She's allowed to use all of these stuff, but she must not let the blood spread out onto the pad, because while she is praying, she should not have any blood, anything, or any clothing on wearing,
which is bloody,
which is stained with blood.
Uh-huh, I see. What about some people who would like to offer the prayers, in fact, separately? Because it is somehow normal for some people, and they like it this
very much.
Of course,
it's more recommended. It's yes. more recommended.
Yes, more recommended too. Yes, of course. So are these ladies, in fact, obliged to perform ghusl more than three times, like in the state of excessive istihada?
You're right. Well, as you rightly mentioned, of course, it is necessary for a woman who offers her Zuhr and Asr prayers or Maghrib and Isha prayers separately.
Yes,
It is necessary for her to perform ghusl, five ghusl, okay, five ghusl. Because as we said, there shouldn't be any gap between the two prayers. And if there is a gap, then of course she has to perform one ghusl for every single prayer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now the question comes up, is she supposed to perform wudu also after the ghusl? According to Ayatollah Sistani, wudu is not required. Wudu is not required. Unlike other religious authorities who say and who are of the view that ghusl istihada is not sufficient for wudu, and that a woman is supposed to perform wudu as well,
mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is not necessary for a woman who is in the state of excessive istihaza to perform wudu after ghusl. Okay,
nice.
So ghusl is sufficient, and therefore, if a woman wants to offer the five times prayer separately, as it is recommended, of course.
Yes.
Then she has to perform one ghusl for each prayer.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back.
Sure.
Don't go away.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islam Gloss on RIB English Radio. We are still on the topic of istihada, the irregular blood discharge. And I'm just going to ask you, Sheikh Javid, about this question. You know, is it permissible for a woman to insert anything other than a cotton to determine the type of istihada, given the fact that you divided into three types?
Oh, well, that's permissible. Of course, it's permissible for a woman to use anything made of wool or cotton or any kind of fabric.
Yes.
To determine the type of istihada.
I see.
Of course, she cannot insert something like a piece of, let's say, something made of plastic, okay,
mm-hmm.
because blood will not penetrate into it.
Yes.
So anything like a piece of cloth made of wool or cotton can be inserted by a woman to determine the type of istihadha, of course.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question would be whether it is permissible for a lady to insert a menstrual cup, for example, or a tampon to prevent the flow of the blood. Is it permissible for a lady to do so?
According to Ayatollah Sistani, of course, it is permissible for a woman to use anything, including taking pills to prevent the flow of blood, okay?
Yes.
Some ladies, for example, travel to Mecca and they want to prevent the flow of blood. Maybe it is the blood of Hayz or monthly period, or it is the blood of Nifas or any other kind of blood. Of course, she is allowed to use tampons, and she's allowed to use a menstrual cup to prevent the flow of blood to other parts of her body. It is permissible. But there is one thing Ayatollah Sistani says, that if a girl is, let's say, virgin and she has the hymen, of course she should make sure that the menstrual cup or the tampons do not somehow damage, let's say, her hymen.
Yes.
Okay? Otherwise, she shouldn't go for the tampon or the menstrual cup.
I see. A very quick question again, since we are at the end of this episode. Is it also permissible to for the ladies to, in the state of istihadha, in fact, to have sexual intercourse during the irregular bleeding?
It is, of course, permissible for a woman to have physical intimacy and sexual intercourse. Of course, it's even if the woman is discharging blood, of course, since it's not menstrual blood, it is kind of irregular blood. Of course, generally speaking, it is permissible for a woman who is in the state of irregular blood, who is in the state of istihadha, to have sexual intercourse with her husband. And the Islamic Sharia has allowed sexual intimacy during istihadha, unlike Hayz, which is absolutely forbidden. And of course, a woman cannot, under any circumstances, have sexual intercourse while she is in her monthly period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If she happens to have a sexual intercourse, of course, she will be liable for a kind of penalty.
Mm.
The amount of penalty is defined, of course, in in the Book of Islamic Laws.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, you are listening to IRIB English Radio and we are here to present another episode of Muslim Lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi and with me my wife
Razia Batul Najafi, Salamun Alaikum wa Rahmatullah wa Barakatuh.
Thank you so much for giving me.
Alhamdulillah. Another beautiful day and another beautiful program. A new day, fresh day with so many fresh information from beautiful school of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam.
So we were discussing about some beautiful and useful tips that how we can keep ourselves limited or how we can keep ourselves away from social media. So can you please recall all those tips you have and we have shared with our
Everyone is looking for easy solutions. So easy peasy, easy baby steps we are discussing, alhamdulillah. Number one is the presence of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. You will enjoy, thoroughly enjoy, because you are not alone. You are in just illusion that you think, oh, this is the screen, this is my time, me time, and I'm just, I can
totally
watch.
Freedom. No, you do not have freedom.
Exactly. You have to give reply to each
so
click
many
and
cameras
seconds.
And eyes are watching you.
I love the way our Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he would say, you can't believe it, we are talking about modesty, chastity, haya, you know, ya arhamar rahimin, how can I explain that our Prophet as a male but still full of modesty and haya. So number one, the presence of Allah. Number two, that we have to be accountable of our deeds, that when I'm having more distraction and I just lose my focus and my aim. And number three, whenever I just slip from my way, so I have to put some punishment for myself. Yeah. And today we are going to discuss about the fourth and the last tip.
Because these tips we have concluded, so maybe our listeners, they can understand some more tips, you know, they can themselves conclude. One of the important tips is to keep ourselves busy, our schedule busy.
Wow.
Yeah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us so many things to do, so many tasks. We have fruitful tasks regarding our upbringing of children, our house chores, even our society roles we have. So if you are busy, so definitely you would not find easily any time to use, waste your time in social media.
which is a very, very important thing. So if you are not busy, so, you know, no matter wherever you are, you can easily switch into the social media and you can waste your so much time generously, you know, which is very, very harmful. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about social media.
If you are free, then easily shayateen can just attack on you and you can just easily slip away from your task. And for that, I think nowadays we need a timetable in detail. Especially, you know, I usually say to mothers in training the children also that usually our children, yeah, they, for example, they go to school, they are busy, they are in a good mood in the morning time. Most of the time from 4 o'clock till 8, for example, afternoon, 5, 6, 7, 8, yeah, this 4 hours, maybe they do some troubles, they need your time, okay? So if you are quality, you know, and full of energy, if you are there for them, then you can easily, you know, manage and cope with your duties easily, you know. Otherwise, it's so difficult. The same way we know ourselves very well that usually I'm free, you know, this afternoon, 4 hours, and I get sleep very easily. So for that 4 hours, I have to have some very timetable and program.
Yeah,
everyone knows himself very well.
Hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, usikum bi taqwallahi wa nazmi amrikum. Yeah, this is the very important thing. If we are organized, we have a very good timetable. So definitely our children will adopt this quality in their life. So if we are very organized, so it's very easy to use our social media, you know, in our limits.
Yeah. And, you know, I say this social media and screen is a beautiful ni'mat, yeah, blessing from Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. So if I'm misusing it, that means I'm not thankful to Allah, because thanking Allah, you know, appreciating the blessings of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala means to use it in a best,
proper way.
For example, as a mother, if I'm given money to my child, yeah, to buy a book, and a child goes and just spend that money to buy some chocolates, and then
harmful,
I get so
thing,
I get so upset. I say, no, you didn't use the money in a proper way. The same way Allah has given me this amazing MacBook, you know, iPad, smartphone, and my time. If I'm using it in a proper way, yeah, that's it. But otherwise, I'm a very unthankful person. وَقَلِيلٌ مِّنْ عِبَادِيَ الشُّكُورِ. Unfortunately, only little, you know, very few people and few servants of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala, they show the gratitude towards Allah tabaraka.
And this is one kind of dhulm also, yeah? Oppression we are doing to these technology and gadgets.
Yeah.
Because dhulm is not always to waste other people's rights or, you know, heart, to do some harmful things for others.
And as a mother, I'm just thinking, like, if I'm misusing, yeah, in my free time, the social media, not only I'm damaging myself, I'm a role model, I'm a teacher, you know, presenter
family.
Of my family, you know, they're just watching. And nowadays, children, they literally, they say, Mom, look at yourself, you know, you look, how come you are
whenever
expecting from us?
Whenever we say to our children that please now stop playing or stop using your gadgets, they say, look at yourself, how much you're always in your, you know, mobile and gadgets busy, and you say to us, don't play a lot.
Yeah.
When we give them the reason that we are listening to the lectures or Quran or something, they are very intelligent. They say, you like these things.
Yeah.
So you spend your time on these things, and we like games, so we want to spend time on games.
Yeah.
So, which is very difficult.
Yeah, therefore we have to
convince
limit, like, yeah,
them.
Especially when yeah. they need us.
The only
we have to be there
thing
for them.
Is we have to limit ourselves in the social media. So this is the last tip. Yeah, we have to make ourselves busy. You know,
and I remember
there's
a beautiful hadith from our Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The gist of the message of this hadith is that in akhir al-zaman, means in this final imam's time, there would be a lot of attacks from shayateen. So if the people of this time in major occultation, yeah, we are awaiting for our final imam, and we are having all these challenges on screen and social media. If we can control ourselves, if we respect the limits, then our status is higher than the martyrs of Battle of Uhud and Badr.
Wow.
Yeah. Why? Because in the time of Prophet, the warriors, they would go to the battlefield to attack and to defend from the enemies in that limited space and time. But nowadays, our battlefield is our screen,
very,
which is 24/7.
Vast,
yeah?
Very big.
Yeah. So always the enemies are attacking, and we are a warrior. We are just defending, yeah, and we are just saying no. So we have to learn how to say no to social media when there's no need of it.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
If we keep ourselves totally engaged in a very healthy activities, like for example, as a mother, nowadays, unfortunately, mothers, they are just sitting, some of them, on social media, yeah? And then they say, oh, my kids are very active. They're always playing. Let them sit. Why they're jumping on so fast, yeah? Because I'm sitting, I feel everyone is moving too much. They're overactive. But if I get active, yeah, if I'm playing with them, I'm exercising with them, I'm working in kitchen with them, yeah, so then I don't feel that they are so much active.
Naughty or
yeah.
overactive. Definitely. This is also a good point, yeah. Unfortunately, we ourselves, you know, we keep away from our children. We just love to provide them with the good food and good clothes and all the, you know, necessary things. But the real thing is our attention, you know, our time. If we are involved with them mentally, physically, then definitely it will have a very, very good impact on their life also.
And I think nowadays one more biggest challenge which a Muslim lady has compared to a Muslim man is that because of her softness and the way she talks, she's more skillful in talking in so many areas. So social media is attracting her more than maybe him. You know,
yeah,
have
definitely.
You seen nowadays because of one of the reasons, because of social media and because of unmodest environment, she is earning more than him, more than father, you know, wife is earning. And I have seen myself in so many families that husband is just asking his wife that you earn. I'm just sitting with my family member, you know, with my kids, and you, because you are earning more, one of us, if the option is that. So because earning is more for female because of her misuse of her beauty. So we have to be very careful. And we as a Muslim lady, we don't maybe sometimes, you know, think about this aspect. And we say, yeah, it's very good because they're giving us so much importance. You know, I'm more valuable than my husband. No. So we have to be very careful because shayateen are just there to make us a victim, to attack on us. So we as a Muslim lady, we are facing more challenges compared to a Muslim man.
And if a Muslim lady, she has a pure intention, so Allah will help her and she can easily manage and easily control these things.
No doubt.
Definitely
no doubt.
The du'as of Aimma Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And the help of Allah is always there, you know. As in Quran, Allah says, if you come one step towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah will come 10 steps towards you. With this, we are coming to the end of this episode. I hope our dear listeners have enjoyed the discussion. And thank you so much for joining us in this program. God bless you and God bless our dear listeners too. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay.
In the limelight.
It is the U.S. that has created or greatly contributed to the economic, climatic, and political instability in many of Latin American and Caribbean countries. As in Afghanistan, the U.S. has moral and legal obligation to respond humanely to this desperate cry for help, says Sonny Robinson Ryder in an article published under the heading Illegal and Inhumane, Biden-Harris on Immigration. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration promised reformed and humane immigration policies. Illegal and inhumane is how Harold Coe, State Department legal advisor, described the Biden administration's escalation of Title 42 as its major immigration control tool. Coe resigned in October 2021. Human Rights First also quotes public health experts as saying Title 42 misuses public health authority to violate refugee law, block asylum at U.S. ports of entry, and expel people seeking refuge to danger. Initially, the administration said it would resume the so-called Migrant Protection Protocol, remain in Mexico, requiring asylum seekers to take a number, thus be metered, while remaining in Mexico awaiting their hearings. In late October, they stated they would end MPP and on November 1st stated they would end metering. But with Title 42 still a major control mechanism, it is not clear what this will change. What occurs when migrants are returned to Mexico or further south? They are subjected to all the potential violence of Mexico. They are at the mercy of drug cartels, people smugglers, and sex slavery rings, some of which involve Mexican officials. They are faced with insufficient numbers of shelters and necessary resources. Corruption and danger remain unimaginably high. Since Biden took office, at least 7,647 kidnappings or attacks on people expelled under Title 42 are identifiable. Since September, 8,000 Haitians have been expelled despite Haitians in the U.S. being eligible for temporary protected status. 8,000 Hondurans and 6,000 Guatemalans, many of them Maya, have been expelled without allowed asylum claims. Despite the claim of not turning away families, 29,000 children, 9,000 of them are under 5 and 600 infants. They have been all expelled. Domestic and international law provide the absolute right for persons fleeing violence to present themselves in the U.S. and make a claim for asylum. Just like under Trump, the Biden administration continues to violate these laws, refusing in many cases to conduct required credible fear interviews. International law prohibits the return of people to situations where they face persecution or torture. The U.S. government may not want more immigrants, especially people of color, but it is illegal not to allow their claims. There were 200,000 entry attempts in July 2021 and 195,555 in August, according to Pew. This is the largest number of people seeking U.S. entry in decades. The Biden administration says it lacks the resources to address these numbers and the human needs they represent, but it has spent unknown sums on detention in deplorable conditions with few social or legal services rather than releasing migrants to their families. They have spent $15 million on deportation flights just to Haiti. Not only of Haitians, many of whom have not lived in Haiti in years, but also of Chileans and Brazilians. Many thousands are being expelled to southern Mexico or into Guatemala and Honduras or moved to western segments of the U.S. border rather than being allowed to remain where they attempt entry. Understandably, the challenges are enormous in Congress and in the country as a whole. However, it is the U.S. that has created or greatly contributed to the economic, climatic, and political instability in many of these Latin American and Caribbean countries. As in Afghanistan, the United States of America has moral and legal obligation to respond humanely to this desperate cry for help. Title 42 needs to be ended and Congress must withhold its funding. Asylum requests should be processed at the border. Detention, removal, and mistreatment of migrants must end. Families should remain together and family reunion in the U.S. should be facilitated. Asylum seekers must have social, financial, and legal services and humanitarian aid. TPS should be expanded where people face grave danger, including Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Yemen, Cameroon, and Afghanistan. Finally, pathways to citizenship for all 11 million immigrants, especially DACA, TPS, and essential workers must be created. We must demand all of this of Congress and the Biden-Harris administration over and over until it is achieved.